Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. And hello there, I'm Loralee, and thanks for tuning into Conversation for Exploration. And welcome back. We are the dream the universe is dreaming, say the Bushmen of the Kalahari. Our lives are the dream we dream in order to wake ourselves up, says my friend Frederick Lehrman. Nothing happens in ordinary reality until it is first dreamed, say some shamans. Our truest life is when we are in dreams awake, said Henry David Thoreau. The ancestors dreamed this world into being, say the Aborigines of Australia. And, says our next guest, we are forever scouting forward in time to explore challenges that lie just around the corner in our waking life. In our dreams, we are all psychic. Robert Moss, a lifelong dream explorer, a shamanic teacher, and a former professor of ancient history and philosophy, born in Australia, a near-death survivor from childhood, and the author of Conscious Dreaming, A Spiritual Path for Everyday Life, says the most important dream book you'll ever read is your own dream journal. He's here to share with us his stories as well as shamanic dream work techniques for embarking on your own dream journeys and adventures, using dream radar as a navigational system in everyday life, gaining insight into practical and spiritual challenges through dreams, communicating with the departed in dreams, and finding out what your psyche has to say to you through your dreams. Hi, Robert. So good to have you here.
It's wonderful to be sharing this dream with you, Laura.
Tell me a little bit about how you got started and to make dreams a focus of your life.
Well, I've always been a dreamer. I had a strange childhood, blessed or blighted, according to your point of view. I had 12 bouts of double pneumonia by the time I was 11 years old, and I kept dying and coming back. A doctor with a bedside manner said to my mother after bout number 3 with double pneumonia, "Give up on this kid, he's never going to make it." Well, I sort of came back. And the reward for spending all this time in the isolation and darkness of sick rooms was an interior life that was very rich and rare.
The only place you had to go for entertainment, right?
Well, it was wonderful entertainment, though. I mean, I had dream visitors and dream guides who helped me through the process of healing. But my problem in my waking life, one that's probably familiar to many of our listeners, was that there was no one around who was prepared to listen to me, give me their full attention, and validate what I was experiencing. I mean, in my family, in my environment, quite conservative, in Australia back in the 50s. You know, to talk about dreams of the departed was considered superstitious or kooky or impossible or the work of the devil or something like that. The first person I found in my waking life who would validate for me that what was happening in my dream experience was real, important, and worth drawing life-supporting guidance from was a boy from a different culture. He was an Aboriginal boy. When I talked about dreams of the departed, for example, Jacko would say matter-of-factly, "Oh, yeah, I dreamed of my dead grandma. She's been gone 10 years. She told my mother what to take for her sciatica." So I was hearing from a boy from a dreaming tradition that values dreams and rewards dreamers, that it is the most natural thing in the world to dream of our departed loved ones and sometimes to draw life-supporting information from them. That put me on a path that it took me a long time to give myself to fully. My dreams pulled me again and again from the weak path of compromise and calculation to the path of heart, which for me is that of the old-fashioned dream of the shaman. And that's what I do now. My dreams called me back to it. For a long time, I lay low. I've done different things in my public life. But a while back, actually, when I moved to this country and started living in upstate New York in Iroquois country, I started dreaming of shamans of long ago who insisted on speaking to me in their own language, an archaic form of the Mohawk language, which I finally had to learn because of my dreams. And this put me on the path I now follow. One thing I would say to our listeners is, if you're following this path of the old-fashioned dreaming, You're going to, I have no theology about this, but I would say this, you're going to become personally convinced of life after life, of its reality. And you're also going to have to deal with two kinds of spiritual beings connected with you, with your own ancestors, with the people of your own bloodlines, your own family, all the way back to, through, you know, your bloodlines to Africa or Atlantis or wherever, or Alpha Centauri or wherever you come from. We're all starborn spirits, after all. And secondly, you're going to have to deal with the spirits of the earth where you live, with the spirits of the first peoples of North America, for example, with the spirits of the land itself, with the animals and birds. They will come to you in your dreaming, too. So I'm a dreamer, you know, I'm not an expert, I'm not a psychologist, I'm certainly not a guru, and one of the messages I have for people who are listening today, which I feel passionate about, is this. This is your power. Your dreams belong to you. They're your own gateway to orders of reality no less real than waking life, in which you can begin to do something that I call soul remembering. To work with dreams is part of soul remembering. You can begin to reclaim the knowledge that belonged to your spirit before you came into this life experience. And when you do that, you begin to live your larger and deeper story. And when you do that, you can live with a courage, a passion, and a generosity that can help you to overcome many of the setbacks and difficulties and illnesses of ordinary life. You will live from a greater depth. You will be different. You will remember who you are and what you can become.
And it's going to make life a lot more interesting and quite an adventure, isn't it?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about those childhood dreams where you first were meeting your guides. What I found interesting was you had a guide named Philemon that was also the name of a guide that appeared to Carl Jung in his dreams.
Well, I didn't know about Jung when I was a kid, but when I was about 7 years old, I started encountering a radiant young man from the edges of the Greek world, eastern side of the Mediterranean, the Syrian coast, from the second or third century of the Christian era. I now think it was the early third century. I didn't know that at the time. I had a generic feel. Philemon spoke to me in the precise but difficult language of the Neoplatonist philosophers, people like Plotinus, who, by the way, in terms of the Western tradition, give us a very exact account of our relationship with the higher self, which is a counterpart to what people go to Buddhism or Hinduism or Vedanta for. We've forgotten, you know, that we have a very exact understanding of these things in the Western tradition.
That's so
too.
Weird, because we take so much of our culture from the Greek, and yet we left out certain key parts of it. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I mean, the shaman philosophers of ancient Greece, who demanded intellectual clarity, but new and experienced in the fashion of shamans. This is part of our inheritance in the West. It deserves to be revived. In my childhood, to go on with answering your question, one of my most important vision guides who came to me in dreamlike states came out of that tradition and reminded me about what Greece knew, what Greece practiced, and what it remembered from Egypt and other cultures. He taught me, as I later read in books, that all true knowledge is anamnesis. It is remembering. It is remembering what belongs to soul and spirit. I cannot teach anyone listening anything you do not already know. The question is, what have you done with that knowledge? You know, human beings are beings who forget and remember and fall and get up again. All true knowledge is remembering, soul remembering. And Philemon, my Philemon, taught me this as a child. Later, 10 years later, when I first read Jung, and I devoured all of him. Jung was a shaman of the West, living in Zurich, the city of cuckoo clocks and bankers and respectability. He didn't call himself a shaman or talk about spirits. He talked about archetypes and gave us this difficult but wonderful scientific vocabulary to explain things that I will describe very directly by my own shorthand. It's a very old-fashioned shorthand. I would talk about spirits and spirit guides. They exist. Jung saw the same thing. The last work of Jung's hands, of his physical hands in his life, was to build at Bollingen on the lake a monument to his Philemon, who he perceived as an old man with the blue wings of a kingfisher. Are our Philemons connected? I don't know. Jung has been a dream guide for me for many years, as I suspect he's been to other people in the West. Jung turns up in the dreams of Westerners, just as other famous individuals do. Is this the spirit of Jung? Perhaps not, but perhaps it is a personality essence, an essence, a personified essence of his teachings, which continues to interface with people today. So my Philemon in childhood was one of my vision guides. It was my Philemon who explained to me what the caduceus, I can't say this word in American, I've become somewhat American. Romanized. I cannot say Caduceus. I have to say Caduceus. What the serpent staff, the staff of healing with the twine snakes around it, still the symbol of our medical profession, though our allopathic Western doctors do not remember what it means. They use it without right. They do not understand that the Hippocratic Oath is to a god who heals through dreams. They don't know that either. My Philemon explained to me what the Caduceus meant. On the night I saw it like a staff of blazing bronze in the sky with physical eyes, the night before I had my last encounter with my death in the form of double pneumonia, and died and came back and stopped getting sick after that. So my experience is one of being called, you know, developing the courage and the clarity to pursue that calling and do it in a way that is useful to other people was a tremendous challenge for me much of this lifetime. You know, you have wonderful experiences and then you have a reentry problem, do you not? Many of our listeners understand this. It can blow you apart. What you see and experience can blow you apart.
It's a spiritual emergency. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is a spiritual emergency. I went through a spiritual emergency in midlife in which I died and came back in a different way, in a shamanic journey. I saw my lifeless corpse carried back from another order of reality in the talons of a storm eagle. I didn't want to come back that time, but I had embarked on the journey voluntarily. It wasn't a crisis of illness this time. It was an initiation. I'll say this about shamans. Shamans are dreamers. They dream in a particularly strong and powerful way. They're the first dream counselors, and the essence of their practice is dreaming in its original sense of accessing other orders of reality. But they're also people who've died and come back. Death is their ally.
You tell the story about an Arctic explorer who asks his Inuit guide, "Are you a shaman?" And the reply came back, "I couldn't be a shaman because I've never been ill and I don't remember my dreams." Will you explain that when we come back? And I liked your comment, I guess, about Jung, that he was to shamanism what Joseph Campbell was to mythology, made it respectable dinner talk to the West. We'll come right back with Robert Moss, author of Conscious Dreaming, a spiritual guide for everyday life. I'm Laura Lee. I'm Laura Lee. This is The Laura Lee Show. Our guest is Robert Moss, author of Conscious Dreaming, a spiritual path for everyday life. Robert, shamans go through grave illnesses and they remember their dreams.
Yes.
I guess, from that Inuit guide's comments. Could you tell us about that?
Well, these are, in fact, the two fundamental descriptions of a shaman. A shaman is a dreamer. In the languages of Native Americans, the most common description for a shaman is one who dreams. In the Mohawk language, for example, it's radzedzots, meaning one who dreams, implying one who dreams a lot, one who dreams powerfully, one who uses, by implication, the information from dreams in a practical and helpful way for other people. Secondly, shamans becoming ill. Shamans are masters of death. The province of shamans is the soul, and that means the souls of the dead as well as the souls of the living. Shamans, by definition, as implied in that, have been through a crisis of illness that may amount to death. Shamans don't talk about the near-death experience, actually. They talk about little deaths or temporary death.
They are near-death experience survivors, then.
Yes, they've died and come, but in shamanic language, they've died and come back. I don't talk in my own terms about a near-death experience. I talk about dying and coming back. I'm one of those who's died and come back quite literally. Since Raymond Moody, we talk about NDEs. But for the shaman, dying and coming back means more than going into the beyond and having a glimpse of the light and maybe even some encounters of a memorable kind. It means developing a personal geography of the afterlife that can be used to help other people. What perhaps many listeners understand, but you know, our mainstream psychologists and religious ministers and so on have not told us, is the dead sometimes require guidance from the living. They get lost or confused. They trust people who have physical bodies more than people who do not, because they're still attached to the earth plane. One of the roles of the shamans is to guide the souls of the dead that get lost and confused, and indeed to bring back the souls of the living who get stuck on the other side. The shamans observe that soul loss, loss of part of our vital soul energy through pain, trauma, abuse, addiction, negativity, is one of the fundamental causes of illness and misfortune. And from a shamanic point of view, it's necessary sometimes to go out and bring back the lost soul part of someone who is sick or unhappy and put it back into them. To do this, you must know what's on the other side. You must have crossed over yourself, and that usually comes through a crisis of illness initially, and later it becomes a voluntary experience.
A question, if we can relate this to modern psychology's views of things. You can talk after a very traumatic episode or event in your life of becoming fragmented, shutting off a part of yourself. This is what happens, apparently, they say, with multiple personalities or some parts of you shut down and just refuse to deal with the pain. Is that what a shot? Was that what you're talking about?
Well,
somebody's
part
of their soul gets lost. It's severed from their...
It might be related, but, you know, our psychological descriptions sometimes confuse the underlying issues. As
okay.
a strong dreamer, a shaman would see the multiple personality disorder, for example, from a shamanic point of view, might often amount to a combination of soul loss, that person has lost part of themselves that is split off and not available, with something close to possession, the presence of entities that do not belong with that person. If you've lost part of yourself, you are vulnerable to something else coming in that doesn't belong with you. And from a shamanic point of view, it would be necessary in a case of multiple personality disorder to decide which of these personalities belong to that person and which do not. Some might be strangers, some might be hitchhikers, some
or
might be things that don't belong there.
Dead, confused person that wants
yes.
a body back
yes.
at any
that's,
cost.
That's right.
For example.
That's, you know, we are constantly in the presence of the dead, and some of the dead are lost and confused, and we can suffer from their confusion and displacement. The fundamental thing is to help people to become whole. While psychologists will talk about, you know, bringing back the inner child or surfacing repressed memories or whatever, shamans will look for that part of that person that is missing and needs to be escorted back to make that person whole through
and
dream work.
And actually make a journey to the dream world,
yes.
find that missing part of that person and escort it back?
That's right.
Wow.
We'll make a conscious dream journey to wherever it is, in the upper world, the lower world, the middle world, or another dimension of the shaman's cosmos.
I have some acquaintances who are bio-prospectors. They go to the Amazon forest and talk with the shamans and learn about their herbs, and they say there's very little mental illness in those cultures.
Well, first
whatever
of all,
the shamans are doing is very effective
yes.
because they just don't see mental illness like you do in the West.
Well, there's a completely different model, you see. I mean, our psychiatrists are trained to return people to ordinary reality in the most shriveled and boring concept of ordinary reality. Shamans are trained to heal people and make them whole by grounding them in a deeper reality than the surface world of the personality. Therefore, depth experiences are regarded as real and important and a source of soul in our lives. The question is to help someone to re-enter this world and operate with that deeper soul knowledge. So it's a different model, you see. It's not about shutting out the visions. It's about helping to ground and center people with their visions in the world that they will now fully inhabit, rather than shutting out the visions and saying reality is just, you know, 3D
mm-hmm.
and doing the job well and getting a good performance report. It's about living from the depth of soul and spirit.
I even liked your comment about people that have intrusive psychotic episodes seeing other realities. You say if you're not dreaming your dreams, if you've taken medicine or if you've become an alcoholic or something, you're not giving space to your dreams, they will come after you and they will impose themselves when you're in waking reality, and that's when people can become delusional. Those dreams are meant to be experienced. They have a message for
you. Our dreams come from a source that is deeper and wiser than our ordinary personality. I'm talking about dreams now in the conventional recognized mm-hmm. sense of the spontaneous night dream. If you shut out your dreams, your dreams will pursue you in the form of nightmares. What is a nightmare? A nightmare is a scary dream you run away from because you don't dare to go on with it. A nightmare is an unfinished dream. If you keep on running away from your nightmares, you know what will happen? The situation the dreams are warning you about will come and bite you in the rear end in waking life, because the dreams are trying to help you respond to challenges in your future. We have this inner radar. It's understandable that since our dreams are body talk as well as soul talk, they would warn us about possible illnesses before physical symptoms develop. If we really wanted to cut, you know, health costs in this country or other Western countries. Pay attention to our dreams. We have dream clinics instead of medical clinics all over the place.
Just like the Greeks did.
You know, once again, our Western physicians take an oath, the Hippocratic Oath, which is originally an oath to Asclepius. They no longer invoke Asclepius, but it is still the words of an oath to Asclepius. Who is Asclepius? He is a god, a personification of healing, who heals through dreams, through sacred sleep. The dream itself is the healing experience. Through our dreams today in the United States or any other Western country, we will attain knowledge of the personal symbols and images we can use for healing ourselves. And if we are open to it, the healing can come through a state of altered consciousness that I call dreaming. This is what we're missing out on if we don't work with dreams and celebrate them in all their vast spectrum of possibility.
And it seems like that's the one chance that the psyche has, or our higher self has, or our soul has, this grander being that we are to really talk to us in that symbolic language.
There's another whole teaching story about that, you know, the hero twins.
Even though I think the whole universe is talking to us all the time if we would but listen.
Oh, yes.
But go ahead with your story.
Yes, let me tell the Navajo story and then comment on what you were just saying.
Actually, I'm going to have you do it on the other side of this break.
Right.
Don't want to cut you off midstream here. And we will continue with Robert Moss. He's got wonderful, wonderful stories. He has looked at the dream culture of various indigenous cultures from around the world and seen what they have in common. You know, I've often heard that there were communities where they share their dreams first thing, the entire community.
Yes.
I didn't know it was the Iroquois was one of them.
Yes.
That was fascinating. We'll come right back and talk more about dreams and what they have to teach us with Robert Moss. I'm Laura Lee. Hey, we are back. I'm Laura Lee. We're talking with Robert Moss about conscious dreaming. We spend a third of our life asleep. Might as well have more fun and gain more of that spiritual insight while we sleep. You had a story for us.
There's a Navajo story about the hero twins back at the beginning of creation, shortly after the beginning of creation. They're going around this world killing all the monsters, and finally they come to the monster of fatigue, the demon of fatigue, and they want to kill this sucker so that people don't get awfully tired and, you know, run down. And fatigue says to them, don't kill me. If you kill me, people won't go to sleep, and if they don't go to sleep, how will they dream? And if they don't dream, how will they remain in contact with the spiritual world? So they let fatigue live. I mean, in that teaching story, as in countless others from indigenous cultures, is the knowledge that dreaming is a way of contacting the dimension of soul, contacting the spirits, letting guidance come through from a deeper quarter. But I wanted to comment also briefly on something you said, Laura. You know, it's not just about what happens when we're asleep, and it's not even just about the possibility of entering conscious dream adventures while waking. This world is also a dream, and this world will speak to us in the manner of dreams if we pay more attention. We need to take dreams in the conventional sense more literally, and the events of waking life more symbolically. If you pay attention to coincidences, chance encounters, patterns around you, random events around you, you'll be doing good dream work that will support your life, and you'll begin to find, as you navigate by synchronicity, one of the things I teach in my book, Conscious Dreaming, as you navigate by the play of coincidence and seemingly random events, that you will not only inhabit a more magical world, because this is natural magic, but you will literally attract different and better people, opportunities, and environments towards you.
Because you're paying attention.
Yes.
I have a friend who keeps a journal, and he will write down key words when he has heard a word, or it's come up for him, or somebody spoke it to him, or he dreamed it, or he saw a symbol for it, or something. If it comes up three times, he goes, aha, it's got a message for me. Pay attention. That's my cue to pay attention. And then he will start keeping a page on that keyword, and then information will just start coming from all quarters. And at the end of it, he'll have a lesson, an insight, you know, a little adventure, something around that key theme, that key word.
Well, that's a great game he's playing. It's a great game he's playing. This is a wonderful game.
He's a student, and the teacher is life, the universe.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. You know, somebody said to me the other day, bottom line it for me, Bob. My name is not Bob, but I went with the flow. What is this all about? What is your book about? What is your teaching about? What is it that you do? I said, I teach people to remember to play. And he starts writing down in his notebook, remember to play. I said, excuse me, I don't think you've got the message straight yet. He was approaching in the spirit of work. I'll get my secretary to schedule an hour when I play. It is about acknowledging, you know, the divine sport in our lives. One of the most important pieces of inner guidance I ever received from what? From my own higher self. Your true life teacher is your own higher self, by the way, if anyone's confused about that. One of the most important pieces of guidance I received in a meditative state from my higher self was this. Remember, this world is not your prison, it is your playground. Now, when we approach things in that spirit, a spirit of play, paying attention to, you know, synchronicity, working with dreams, being creative, doing things spontaneously, being prepared to be spontaneous, life is different and it's better and it's healing. And we can do much better stuff. So that's what it's about.
And when we enjoy our life and go at it with a zest and all of that, we are doing our soul a favor. After all, we're participating in the activities that it finds worthwhile here on Earth. Isn't that what you say in your book?
Yes. This is walking the path of soul and spirit. There are many ways to do this. I mean, I work with and closely and will always honor the spontaneous wisdom of sleep dreams, but I also help people to access other states of consciousness simply and safely that will enable them to embark on conscious dream journeys. In a workshop, we use shamanic drumming to facilitate the shift in consciousness, because the primal heartbeat drumming, this is not concert music, is the simplest and fastest way I know to get people out of their left brains into a more spacious and generous region.
Well, automatically your brain waves tune to that beat, so depending on... You know, you're altering your brain waves, therefore you're going to alter your experience.
Well, you can come at it that way if that's what appeals to you. You can say that sonic driving herds the brain waves into the theta band 4 to 8 hertz, 4 to 8 beats
okay.
per second.
Tell it to me another way.
I might say to you that it enables your soul or your dream body to get loose from your physical body and travel somewhere interesting, because we have out-of-body experiences all the time in our sleep and we can have them consciously.
Actually, I see it that our soul body is having adventures all over the universe and other dimensions, and our soul is having a life not just attached to this body. It's just that our conscious waking seems to be attached to this body when we're awake, unless we take conscious efforts to expand it and to see what else our soul's out there doing. Hey, I want to participate in all the adventures my soul's having, and too often that's leaving my small waking self behind.
That's a very good way of putting it, which leads me to offer two reflections. The first is this. We have a physical body, but unknown to or unadmitted by mainstream Western medicine and psychology, we have other vehicles. We have a dream body or second body or astral body, which can also do neat stuff. And we have other vehicles of spirit available to us, and they can do things independently of the physical body as they do in dreams. The second thing is this. The mind is never in the body. You know, this whole Western attitude that, you know, we have a body with a brain, which is a computer made of meat, is so impoverished and sterile. And no wonder we are hungry for meaning, and we have diseases that flow from our lack of a personal experience of the sacred. You know, what I offer in this approach and what you offer in your own way, your show is a healing experience, Laura. What we need is a personal access to experience of the sacred, of the deeper ground of transcendence. Our healing will flow from that. But, you know, our mind is never confined to the body, to resume the main point. Our mind is never corralled in 3D physical reality. The home of your body is the cosmos, and beyond the cosmos as you understand it. Therefore, it is the most natural thing in the world. Nothing spooky, occultist, a hole in the corner about it. The most natural thing in the world for you to be able to go forward into the future, or backwards or sideways in time, and to enter other dimensions of reality that are no less real than this one. Because when you remember how to dream again, and you are all born dreamers, when you remember how to dream again, you will be convinced of one thing, certainly. You will know that there are worlds beyond this one. There are worlds beyond this physical reality, and you'll become progressively more at home in them, which is a neat trip.
And when you have those dreams, they feel so much more real to you that this waking reality that we call real pales by comparison. And then you have woken up. You've taken a step to that waking up process. I know that you talk about flying in your dreams. I remember one of my earliest dream memories is having what I understood to be angels, spirit guides, whoever they were, on either side, take one of each of my hands and teach me how to fly in my dreams.
It pursued
from there. I met all sorts of wonderful spirit guides in my dreams with very, very, very profound dreams and teachings, and also comforting. It was very comforting to know that here was a reality where I felt at home, where I felt understood, where it made sense, because this waking reality did not make sense to me as a child, and I felt very forlorn, and I felt, you know, where is my family? And my mom and dad were doing a great job, but it was like, it was just not, something was missing in terms of their keying into who I was. And so I decided from an early age, this world is crazy, and there's something beyond there. There has to be. I'm not crazy. It's this world that's crazy.
That's
dissonant.
That's a very beautiful experience. It's one that touches me and resonates with me quite deeply, because I certainly know what it is to feel homesick for another world, another order of reality. And many of our listeners know that too. We need to do a couple of things. We need, first of all, to remember where we come from, that we are bright spirits who inhabit these bodies. But then secondly, stop feeling sad about that and bring the energy and brightness of spirit into this lifetime, into this physical world. Be fully present. Our time is now. Stop mourning lost palaces and lost civilizations and be here now. When people ask me, you know, what do I need to do this kind of work, this conscious dreaming? I say, well, relax. You know, a lot of Westerners have forgotten how to relax. They don't even know how to breathe without going through some numbers count or something. Relax. Be here, be present, be now. Your time is now. All your past and future is accessible now. Be here now.
Yeah.
And expect the unexpected, because people put themselves on programs, even spiritually oriented programs, which program out the unexpected and the joy of spontaneity. We need to do dream work with the events of everyday life, and people forget how to do that.
You know, you don't have to go too far to get into the juiciness of the whole picture, do you? It's all around us if we just look at it.
Absolutely.
And see it.
You know, your dreams are flying. I mean, I was once doing a dream workshop for a Friends of Jung Association, and one of the psychologists, a Jungian, mind you, I mean, a Jungian, gets up when I'm congratulating a woman on her flying experiences in one of the dreams and says, I'm very troubled. I said, what's the problem? He said, flying is not a natural human activity. I said, excuse me, you are born to fly. You two are born to fly. Flying is in dreams the most natural human reality. And when we remember how to dream, we feel our feathers growing again. We become winged spirits again. Dreams of flying, by the way, are often reflective of out-of-body experiences or experiences in which we are clearly outside the physical dimension. For shamans, they may be shamanic types. They may be shape-shifting experiences in which you're flying on the wings of a bird, for example. You know,
I dream a lot
too.
About birds. Birds are always showing up in my life, both in this physical world and in my dreams. Yeah. What's that all about?
Well, you're probably a member of the bird tribe.
It's the second time I've heard that.
One of the quickest ways, if you're on a shamanic path, to shift consciousness and embark on a conscious dream journey is to see yourself borrowing the wings of a bird who is closely connected with you. I mean, there's a story in my book about my relationship with the sea eagle, a magnificent aquatic raptor native to the northern coast of my native country, Australia, and also to the northern coast of the country of my ancestors, Scotland. A familiar of the shamans, of the Celtic shamans, of the Hebrides and the Highlands and Islands of Scotland in the old days, as it is a familiar of the shamans of the Torres Straits off the northern Australian coastline today. He's come to me many times when I've needed to do something he's wanted to show me about, and I have flown on his wings on long journeys and been quite conscious of doing so and felt quite safe and indeed wonderful in doing it. So from a shamanic point of view, we are born with a relationship with animals or birds specific to us, as well as with a relationship with natural energies and spiritual counterparts in other times and other worlds. And part of the shamanic path of dreaming is to honor these relationships and work with them. You know, so you're a member of the bird tribe, from my point of view. And why not? It's a good tribe to belong to.
And I'll see eagles. Whenever I'm having a significant thought or a particular moment, I'll look up and often there'll be an eagle flying by or something. So.
Well, you'll get confirmation from the world in this way. You know, again, you know, our conventional speech is so impoverished. We talk about dreams as only dreams. And even if we're beyond that, we think, oh, they're sleep dreams, stuff that goes on during the night, and that's all it is. Dreaming is possible in many different states of mind. You know, one of my favorite spheres of exploration is in the twilight zone between sleep and waking, or between waking and sleep, which is great territory for dream explorers. I can travel far and wide and get very accurate information in that state in a quite relaxed way. It starts by following the flow of images behind your closed eyelids. Getting deprogrammed, off schedules, away from theories, and letting the experience unfold and following it.
And you do that by paying attention to your thoughts and being quite aware. It's a self-identity kind of thing as well. Tell us about dreaming the future.
Well, dreaming the future is a perfectly natural and routine activity. We need to get beyond the gee whiz, this is weird syndrome, and beyond the silly reductionism that says it ain't possible, and just start logging our own experiences. I've been working with my personal dream journals for more than 30 years now, and I'm still learning about what is possible through journaling. I have logged thousands of correspondence between my dreams and subsequent events, including very minor ho-hum things. For example, I mean, I dream while traveling in Europe that I'm giving a lecture in the United States and the fan on the ceiling is so noisy people cannot hear my lecture. When I come back, I do a reality check. I think about where I'm giving a lecture that this dream could be advising me about. I identify a college where I'm giving a lecture but haven't been there when the air conditioning is on. I go over to the college, ask them to turn on the air conditioning. The fan is very noisy. So I have the lecture transferred to another lecture theatre where I can be heard. That's useful, practical stuff. I also call it ho-hum minor stuff. Some people listening to us will say, gee whiz, wow, or it ain't possible. That's routine stuff for me. And it's routine stuff, by the way, for our listeners, whether or not they're working with dreams this way at the moment. We have a natural, God-given radar, an inner radar, which enables us to scan our environment at a distance and see into the future. It's what kept us alive when we were naked apes, facing the whole menagerie of Jurassic Park for real. We had no good weapons. It was dangerous to go to sleep, but we could, while asleep, through our inner sensors, see into across space and time and see that saber-toothed tiger before it had us for breakfast. Okay, this belongs to you. Except it's natural, it's even routine. The question is to start improving your dream recall and scanning all your dream material for possible precognitive elements and working with it for yourself. Don't listen to me on it, go and do it.
Well, that's why cars have headlights, so that you can see ahead in the path before you get there and slam into a brick wall. You can divert, you can change course, you can guide yourself by having a little forward knowledge.
Yes. So
we'll come right back with Robert Moss. I'm Laura Lee. Hi, Laura Lee, back on The Laura Lee Show, talking with Robert Moss about conscious dreaming. It's not just conscious dreaming you're talking about, it's conscious living, isn't it, Robert?
Yes, this is about bringing the energy and insight of dreams into waking life.
What kinds of questions, comments would you like to hear from our listeners? What things do you like to discuss with people about dreams?
I'd like to help our listeners live their best dreams and get over whatever fears dreaming causes them at the moment. I'd like to help them to live with passion and generosity. So any question they need to ask is the right question.
No limits on the dreams. Go ahead and share with us on The Laura Lee Show your question. Hi there. Hello.
How are you, Laura Lee?
I'm doing well. What's your first name and where are you from?
I'm Ted. I'd like to speak to you, Mr. Moss, about your discussion tonight. I have three incidents that occur to me that you might find interesting in regards to what you're talking about. I'm 60 years old now, and I was very confused until I was about 28, and I read a book by Carl Jung, and I was very impressed by it, and I started doing these mandalas.
One thing I always do with a dream is I try and come up with a one-liner, a dream motto that will orient my life based on this dream. If this is my dream, Ted, I'm going to say, to get to this money, I have to go through a lot of crap, you know, and I can't get clean afterwards. So do I really need this money? But before I do that, if it's my dream, I'm going to run a reality check, because I do this with every dream, however strange it seems. I'm going to ask, however weird it may sound, is it possible that in some restroom somewhere I'm going to find some money? Now it might seem unlikely, but I'm going to hold that possibility open because, as I say, we dream about external events all the time. But I'm going to come up with a one-liner like that. I'm never going to tell anyone else what their dream means. I'm going to say, if it were my dream, it might suggest this or that to me. And I'm going to suggest ways you can begin to harness the energy and insight of the dream in your waking life. How did you feel when you woke up, Ted?
I felt like I had a load off my...
You felt relieved.
My shoulders.
You felt relieved.
A 500-pound gorilla. And one more thing. I met if they stay in a craft long enough, they hope to create a masterpiece. And I met one master in the last week, and he happened to be in the craft, a priestcraft. He's a Buddhist. He does his liturgy perfectly. I mean, the ratios and the resonance is I've never heard.
And you felt you were finding a teacher in this fellow?
Yes.
Okay, well, find the teacher, follow him, but don't make him your master. Don't accept anyone, however wonderful, as your guru or master. That's my counsel to you. Take from him what he has to offer as a teacher and go beyond it. Any true teacher will say that to you, by the way.
I agree.
Go back to your drumming, too. Drumming is soul work. Don't leave the drumming. Go back to it. I use drumming all the time, and it works wonderfully, not only to shift consciousness, but to raise energy. You sound as if you're on a good path, Ted, and I hope you'll follow it. And that dream sounds as if it was a watershed for you, a moment of transition. I would work with that. I won't tell you what any of it means. I'll just tell you some of the associations that come to me, borrowing your life and your dream for a moment as my own. We can all share this gift with each other of listening to them closely and offering our views as if it were our dream.
When we come back, we'll hear more stories. For example, Robert, I want to find out, what is Tibetan dream yoga? You talk about that. We'll share that with you when we come back on the other side of this break coming up. I'm Laura Lee. Hey, we are back sharing some real interesting stories, discussions, insights, experiences with Robert Moss on conscious dreaming. His book is Conscious Dreaming, A Spiritual Path for Everyday Life. Robert, we had a gentleman on, I'm not going to name names, who was talking about remote viewing, and the attitude that came across got me more and more upset as time went on. The more after, this is after the interview, the more I thought about it. And he was saying, well, we have the military that has done all these experiences. They've conducted, who's going to trust the military anyway? We have done all these experiences. They've done all these experiences and had various people do this remote viewing on these various aspects. And let me tell you what the deal is. And I expect you to believe this as, you know, historical fact. And I'm going, And this is just as bad as a mediary to God that some priesthood could set up and say, no, go through me because we have all the answers and we're the mediator. I don't think that there should be a mediator between us and what our own consciousness and the realm of consciousness out there has to tell us or to show us, nor do I necessarily believe the remote viewing adventures of someone else. But I guess what I'm saying is that I had grave reservations of someone else telling me, you know, let me be the mediator and tell you what the realm of consciousness can give us in terms of believing in remote viewing.
Good for you in standing up to this guy. We don't need the middleman in these respects. We want to know about remote viewing, which is part of your natural birthright. You have the ability to see across space. Try it for yourself. For example, don't do this if you're driving your car right now. For example, get relaxed and start visualizing a second self. Start visualizing a second you moving around the room beyond or sitting opposite you or floating over your head, however you see it. See your second self. Make it real. You know, look at the back of your head or whatever you choose to look at. And then, you know, see if you can transfer some part of your consciousness to your second self and travel around the room and start looking at something in the room you haven't noticed with your physical eyes. Your eyes are closed during this, of course.
Okay.
And then, of course, if you're succeeding in looking around your room closely, see if you can send your second self and part of your consciousness with it out of that space and start checking out the nearby neighborhood. Recently, for example, as a game, I mean, this is all about playing deeper and better and more fun games. Remember to play. Recently as a game, I borrowed a friend's studio. She's a very fine artist in New York City, and she had done a wonderful diorama, you know, a dream diorama. It showed a house and a cavernous underworld below it and a moonlit sky above. And I gathered a group of friends in her studio, and I asked them to look at this diorama for a while, then lie on the floor, close their eyes, and with the aid of the drumming, enter that diorama that she had created, travel beyond it if they wanted to on a conscious dream journey, or just check it out and live inside it. They came back with information that could not be seen from the outside of this diorama. One guy could describe elements in the artwork that could not be physically seen with physical eyes from the front of the display. Practical demonstration of the reality and natural nature of the projection of consciousness. You can do these things for yourself. It doesn't have to be an academic debate or a sub-academic debate, which is often what it amounts to. The scientific approach, the real scientific approach, is to go and try it and gather new data and not sit around debating old data and what the Pentagon might or might not have done in its possible abuse of, you know, psychic facilities. By the way, another responsibility we have is not to tolerate, not never to tolerate, the abuse of psycho-spiritual gifts for any, you know, material or political purpose. I mean, I'm very clear in my own duty in relation to this. Profound psychic gifts come with the development of the dreaming. That is the heart of the practice. That is what life is fundamentally all about, becoming more conscious of what we're thinking, feeling, and doing or not doing in this dream of life. And we should not ever tolerate the perversion of the powers that come through this approach for any less than healing and human and spirited purpose.
I think we should also understand that there are many languages in which this gift can be spoken. It can be symbolic, it can be literal, it can be, they're just metaphorical. There's many, many languages. And so I think that whatever you're seeing, whatever you're dreaming, as you would say, try to, you know, do a reality check. Is this literal? Is this symbolic? try to find out what language is being spoken. That can also be helpful.
Dreams in the sense of night dreams are multi-layered, and we dream in different ways. There are Freudian dreams, particularly if you've been shrunk to death by a Freudian shrink, you're going to have lots of them. So there are many different techniques of approaching dreams that may apply to an individual dream and open up different levels of its meaning.
Our next caller to the Lurley Show is...
Hi, this is Cindy from Carson City, Nevada.
Hi, Cindy.
Hi, our first-time caller also, so I'm excited to get through. I was listening to Robert Moss and him talking about keeping a journal of your dreams, and I had a question to pose to him about that. About 5 years ago, I started having dreams of what I would call earth changes and things like that, and I kept telling people about it, and they said, you ought to keep a record of this. So this year, my New Year's resolution was to keep a record of these dreams that I have. Well, when I started keeping a record of the dreams, those kind of dreams stopped, and I started having just really weird off-the-wall dreams, like, you know, cows flying and stuff like that. So I continued to keep the record, continued every day. And finally, in late March, I gave up writing in the journal because I wasn't having the dreams that I was having before. Since I stopped keeping the journal, I've started having these type of earth change dreams again. So I was wondering what Mr. Moss thought of that.
Well, Cindy, you leave me sort of puzzled in an interesting way, because as I listen to you, and if I make your experience my own experience, you know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking I'm putting my daily self, my daily trivial mind, as Yeats called it, in charge of my dream source. I'm judging whether these dreams are weird or wacky or useful or not, and I'm letting myself in my everyday mind, with my everyday conceptions, judge whether these dreams are meaningful or not. All dreams are meaningful. Yes, there are big dreams and little dreams.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to judge or edit my dreams. I mean, I can't comment on your experience. I can only relate it to my own experience. And In my experience, I have found that dreams that, if not properly worked with, might be considered wacky or weird or just ho-hum or trivial, turn out to contain life-supporting messages. For example, let me just take a fragment that you've mentioned. A flying cow. Why shouldn't a cow fly? Why shouldn't a cow fly? Maybe the cow is me if it's my dream, or the bull, or the ox, or whatever it is. Uh-huh. And why can't I fly? I mean, I work with every kind of dream. And the idea that one should select one category of dreams as significant and others as not significant seems to me to go against what the dream source is trying to tell me. As far as the earth change dreams are concerned, I would want to get the details straight. I would want to write them down. And if they're not coming back, maybe it's because they're not actually as useful or susceptible to work in daily life as you might think if you're not recording them. I can't judge this. I'm just going to say this. If you have a dream of a natural disaster, if I have a dream of a natural disaster, taking it back to myself, notice the way I'm commenting on these things. If we're going to share dreams with each other and discuss them, we have to say if it were my dream. Otherwise, it's intrusion. If I have a dream of an earthquake, I'm going to do my reality check and check whether there is a possibility of a literal earthquake in my area. I might need to go back inside my dream in a relaxed state to see the exact situation. And if for some reason I conclude there is not a physical possibility of an earthquake, I'm going to look at this dream symbolically and ask myself, what part of me is ready to erupt, break open, break its boundaries, and overwhelm
me? Or symbolic? How do you go back? And thank you, Cindy. How do you go back into a dream in a relaxed state and pick up more information that you may have missed the first time around?
Well, I offer various techniques. I mean, the best one probably is to stay in bed or go back to bed, if you can relax, and let yourself slide into the location of the dream. Location, location, location. The realtor's motto is a good motto for dream workers, too. Focus on the dreamscape and try and get yourself back inside it and try to get more information. I mean, I could share some fascinating stories of how this has worked with life-supporting messages. In the dream workshops that I lead, we might use the drumming to facilitate the shift in consciousness, to put you back inside a dream you need to clarify, with a partner going with you sometimes, which becomes an exercise in shared dreaming, the two of you inside a dreamscape, getting the information you need to get the message clear. I'm not content to have a dream.
That's very VR, doesn't
it? I'm not content. Well, see, that's the external model again. You can do this yourself. You don't need a gadget. You don't need a video arcade. You don't need to walk to Mr. Gates or anybody else to sell you the software. You can do this in your own head.
We come all equipped. We just forget to turn the equipment on.
That's well said. That's well said. You know, you have a radar more sophisticated than anything the Pentagon used during the Gulf War. If you're not using it, well, that's your choice. What I'm offering you are various techniques for using it.
We need more pages to our owner's manual of the human body and mind, don't we? Next caller to the Lurley Show is, hello.
Hello, this is Amy from San Francisco, KPIX.
Hi, Amy.
Hi. In listening to what Robert was saying earlier when you were discussing MPD about part of the soul being missing and perhaps having a hitchhiker, I would like him to elaborate a little bit more on that. How do you determine if that is what is wrong, and what do you do about it? Do you get rid of the hitchhiker? How do you retrieve the missing part of the soul? That kind of thing?
Good stuff. Thanks for the question. I'll try and, you know, respond as carefully and as briefly as I can. I mean, this is big stuff. This is the heart of healing from the shamanic perspective. Let me take the dream focus for a moment, because, you know, one of the great gifts of spontaneous sleep dreams is they present our issues to us in a way that helps us to deal with them, and in a timely fashion. They show us what it is timely for us to deal with. Now, you know, many of us...
And speaking of time, we'll come right back after just a couple of more minutes, and we'll continue just this answer to just that question and take more of your phone calls for Robert Moss. I'm Laura Lee. Hey, Laura Lee, back on The Laura Lee Show, talking with Robert Moss, the topic, conscious dreaming. Robert, you were just about to explain an answer to Amy's question.
Well, let me come at this question, which is about soul loss and hitchhikers and what is often diagnosed, in my opinion, in unhelpful ways as MPD or multiple personality disorder, by bringing it back to our thoughts about dreams. You know, in night dreams, we sometimes see a younger self separate from ourselves, you know, a five-year-old self who is still in some location, and we think sometimes that this is a dream about a childhood house or whatever, but the detail I want to focus on is looking at a younger version of yourself in your dream. Vietnam vets, you know, often seeing them, a younger self, maybe, you know, 20 years younger now, back in Vietnam going through the horrors of the war. From a shamanic point of view, such dreams often indicate the fact that part of the dreamer is missing, has been gone because of that childhood abuse or that Vietnam experience, but because of the dream is now ready to come back. You know, the fact that you see your younger self in the dream, it's an indication from my point of view that you might be ready for soul recovery.
They want to come back.
You know, and this is fairly, you know, here I'm a fairly literal person about these things. This is a literal soul or soul part or part of the self that's been gone. The fact that it's appearing in the dream is an indication, a very positive indication to me, that that part might be ready to come back. For example, can I tell a story about this?
Oh, yes, please.
Own work as a shamanic counselor and dream worker. A woman who came to me at one point was dreaming of her five-year-old self. Maybe that's why I mentioned the age five just now. And the dream was so powerful that it suggested the need to look into the situation. And when I journeyed on it, I shifted consciousness and looked for her five-year-old self. I found a five-year-old Kathy that was missing from her adult self, and I talked to her five-year-old, and I asked her, you know, aren't you ready to come back? She was enjoying the scene, the drumming, the animals, the play stuff. She was quite close. She wanted to come back. But she said, well, I'm ready to come back and live with my adult Kathy, but, you know, can you promise me I won't be punished for breaking the dishes? I didn't understand this. But in a shamanic way, I brought this part back with Kathy's permission and gave it back to her and sealed it all up. And then I asked Kathy, what does this mean to her, breaking the dishes? See, this isn't some hypnotherapist suggesting stuff. I'm asking it humbly and not telling her it's so. What is this stuff about breaking the dishes? I don't understand it. Kathy blanks out for a moment and says, oh, my God. When I was five, my father, in a drunken rage, beat my elder sister for breaking a dish in the kitchen. My elder sister ran out on the street and was murdered that night. That is when that Kathy lost part of herself. So that's an example of how dreams can indicate not only what we have lost, but the timeliness of getting it back. If we are not complete, if we have lost a part of our soul energy, a part of our vital self for whatever reason, then we are vulnerable to other things coming in to fill it, addictions, illnesses, things that don't belong with it. You know, a lot of people pick up hitchhikers. When I hear people talking about the reincarnational experience, as a Celt, by the way, I'm quite sympathetic to the idea of reincarnation, don't get me wrong. But when I hear people going on about their reincarnational experiences, I sometimes realize I'm listening to the memories of dead people attached to them. Now, what do you do about it, to answer our question? From my point of view, I have to dialogue with those dead people because they're my clients as much as the living person. I have a keen interest in the souls of the departed as well as the living. I've been talking to dead people all my life, so there's nothing weird about this to me. My role as a facilitator, if the person can't do it for herself, which I much prefer to enable people to do all this stuff for themselves and give them the tools to do it. I don't want to come between people and communications from the departed, for example. But if there's a problem, if there's someone attached, a hitchhiker, to use our caller's phrase, which is a good phrase, if there's a hitchhiker attached to someone who shouldn't be there and is inflicting sometimes feelings, depression, rage, even physical symptoms on the living, I would dialogue with that person and try and figure out why she's there. There are a lot of dead people who don't know they're dead. That's why a lot of dead people are attached to the living. They don't even know they're dead. Why? We don't have a practice of dying in this culture. By the way, dream work is a great preparation for dying. The Plains Indians say that the path of the soul after death is the same as the path of the soul in dreams, except that after death you won't come back to the same body. So to keep the answer, answer simple for now, when I come across spirits of the departed that are lost or confused, I do a couple of things. I try and dialogue with those departed people and try and clarify the path they should be on in their own terms and try and open them to an experience of the light and an encounter with vision guides. People without any specific training can do this. Let me share another dream that was shared with me recently. It came from an elderly woman, farmer's widow, and not a dreamer, she thought, not someone who had worked with dreams most of her life. But she had a dream of her departed mother who had died 2 months before this. And in her dream, she's in her mother's house, and there is her mother, and her mother is alive in her dream, as the dead are in our dreams. In our dreams, the dead are always alive, right? Almost always alive. So she's in the house with her departed mother, and there is her father, who died 10 years ago. And her father is standing behind her mother, but her mother is not listening to her father, doesn't even know he's there. Are you with me?
Okay.
And the father is saying to the dreamer, please tell mom to turn around and look at me and hear me and acknowledge I am here because I need to help her. And inside her dream, the farmer's widow says to her mother, mom, stop talking to me, turn around and look at dad, he's here to guide you. She turns around and talks to dad. And at this point, she leaves in a blaze of light, and she comes back once more in the dreamer's dreaming to confirm that everything is fine. She's found the path of love and light. What did this dreamer do? She did soul work. She acted as a guide and counselor of her departed mother's soul, and she had no training for it. She just knew how to do it when the moment came when her father spoke to her in her dream, and in her dream she listened to him and allowed him to become the guide for her mother. We can all do this. It's natural. It's not weird. We don't need middlemen. We need to remember our birthright as dreamers, and through the dreaming we will remember everything we need to know. This is my message.
Next call in the Laura Lee Show for Robert Moss. Hello.
Hello, yes. My name is Chris, and I'm a first-time caller. Laura Lee, I love your show and your lively interaction with your guests.
Thank you.
Robert, I appreciate your energy and your clarity on many very complicated subjects. I've had several magical dreams myself, some of which have seemed to blend with reality. Several years ago, I left my body, and in that state, you know, I didn't possess an analytical mind, I guess, and I didn't possess a soul, per se.
What do you think you were traveling
in?
You
are a soul. Maybe
you are a soul.
Possess a soul.
Well, it was not a soul in the sense of having any history or any particular color. It was just pure perception.
Mm-hmm.
And it was 360 degrees. I could see the entire room. And my movements in space were simply willed. There was no thought whatsoever. It was just an absolute pure state. And then I moved into my body. It's as if there was a decision, although I didn't make a particular decision as one would make one in a conscious mind. I just moved into the body and put it on, much like one would put on a glove. When I awoke, I possessed a state of pure knowingness, I guess, and I knew that this state would last 1 week. And then I wrote down some things about what I could see about people and what have you, and I noticed that there were seven basic energies represented in my mind as the concepts of colors. This is simply how I comprehended the complexity, I guess, of these energies. And these seven colors represented seven basic varieties of personality or states of awareness, I guess you might say.
Okay, Chris, you shared a very big experience with us, and we're glad that you did. Let me just say this to you very briefly. It is difficult for us to relate or recount some of these experiences in the vocabulary we've been given. I mean, I noticed that you were struggling with some words. I mean, will versus thought, etc. I hear where you're coming from. You had a big experience. You ought to trust it. The natural home of our mind is not in the body. Our body exists within a larger field of identity. You know, the Iroquois Indians say that if you have a big dream, and when they say dream, they don't just mean sleep dreams. Okay, if you have a big inner experience, one of two things is happening. Either you're out of your body, and out of your body, your spirit has the ability to travel to all sorts of interesting places, to other worlds and other times and so on, or else you're having a visit from some being that is in a similar condition. This might be another dreamer who is traveling outside her body, or it might be a spiritual guide, or it might be an ancestor, or whatever. It might be an angelic figure. The things we have, the things we perceive, I want to say this, and as clearly as I can, the things we perceive are related to our degree of understanding. Take spiritual guides, for example. You know, we will see our spiritual guides in the forms we are ready to receive. I once taught a dream work class for an Episcopalian congregation in a fashionable church in New York. I'll teach dreaming to anyone who's ready for it. And during the break, up comes a nice but careworn woman who'd obviously given a lot of herself to service. And she says to me very earnestly, "Can I meet my guardian angel in my dreams?" Well, I don't beat around the bush. I said, "Absolutely." She looks very worried. I said, "What's troubling you?" She said, "Well, I've asked to meet my guardian angel in my dream several times, and each time I got Garfield the cat." Now, you know, angel means messenger. So I played a game. You might want to play with your own dreams when you're sharing them with other people or when you're commenting on someone else's dream. I played the game of being an alien from outer space. It's not hard to imagine. I talk funny. Wherever I go in the world, people say, "Where do you come from?" So I said, "Okay, I've just arrived from Alpha Centauri. Who is Garfield the cat?" She says, "Oh, he's greedy, he's selfish, he's always looking out for himself." I said, "Well, could Garfield the cat be an angel in the modest sense of a messenger?" She looks behind her to the buffet and the chocolate cake on the buffet, and she says, "You mean I could have a piece of that chocolate cake at the end of the evening?" I said, "Garfield says, absolutely." Don't let's lose our sense of humor. One thing I counsel people on in relation to this is, if you don't have a sense of humor, you're not ready. I once said to a group, "As I get older, I divide people into two types fundamentally, those who have a sense of humor and those who do not." And a woman in the front row, very earnest, very dedicated, said, "Why?" I said, "Excuse me, you're not ready. Keep your sense of humor. In your little mind, in my little mind, we are not ready to understand a whole heck of a lot. Okay, if you don't have a sense of humor, you'll get trapped in concepts and dogmas. The fact that they're New Age dogmas rather than medieval dogmas doesn't make them any less dogmas. I don't like dogmas. I like experience. I like fresh, spontaneous, first-hand experience. And I thank Chris and others of you who are sharing their own personal experiences with us tonight.
When we come back, Robert, I would love to hear a couple of stories about how you process the dream, because that is how we get up close and personal with our dreams and with understanding what the message is. And I guess we can get trapped. I mean, there's too many books out there. Oh, if it's a white cat, it means this. If it's a kitchen sink, it means this.
Right.
I think you have some insights in that you could lend all of us to. There's lots of techniques to write your dreams down, make space for it, have the tools there. How do we sit with that dream afterwards?
Right.
And how do we unravel the message that it has for us, as do we with synchronicity in life, with messages that are all around us as one big fabric that's woven? It's the pages of our life. It's the story that the universe is writing for us of our life. We'll come right back and hear more on that from Robert Moss and Conscious Dreaming. I'm Laura Lee. Hi, I'm Laura Lee. You're listening to The Laura Lee Show. Our guest is Robert Moss. His book, Conscious Dreaming, A Spiritual Path for Everyday Life, is a very good read. Robert, will you tell us a couple of stories to illustrate your processing of your dreams?
Yes. Okay. The story is the shortest route between a human being and the truth. So let me get into the process of dream working through a story. Okay, here's one. It relates to some of the issues callers have already asked about. A woman friend of mine calls me at 6:30 in the morning. Now, you don't get good phone calls at 6:30 in the morning normally. And she's upset. And what is it? She says, "I've had this dream." And in her dream, she's seen a former boyfriend attacked and apparently stabbed to death with his female companion in a deserted parking lot. That's the dream, essentially. And she's upset for two reasons. First of all, She thinks this is real and it might be going to happen. And since she's a clear dreamer, someone who has in the past reported accurate dreams of future events and distant events, we have to take that very seriously. Secondly, she's ready to go on a guilt trip. You know, I want that SOB dead because he's with her instead of me. She's ready to blame herself for wanting him dead and psychologize it away. Well, instead of sitting around playing head games, I ask her to go back inside the dream and get more information. One thing our listeners should be very clear about is your memory of your dream is not the dream itself. Your dream is a real experience, real in its own terms. Don't let anyone tell you it's not a real experience. It is. Your memory might be broken, fragmentary, garbled, fogged, broken shards. You need to go back inside the dream often to clarify its meaning or resolve unfinished business. So I'm asking her to go back inside her dream. How does she do that? I ask her to relax, focus on the location, the parking lot, and let herself slide back in the dream. And I give her two instructions. First of all, try and get better information on where you are and what's happening. And second, see if you can change the ending of the dream in a way that seems natural to you. She goes back inside the dream. I've talked her into the dream. She gets wonderful information. She can now describe the building with its columns, a grand public building. She can describe the muggers as exactly as a police identikit artist would need to draw a picture of them. She can describe other details of the scene. She cannot change the ending of the dream in the way that seems natural to her. She sees them killed again. She tries to bring in the cops and do all sorts of other cute fiction writing stuff. It doesn't work. She sees her friend, her former boyfriend, and the woman killed again. What does she do now? Now, what I counseled her to do, I wouldn't necessarily counsel anyone else who has a dream which seems to contain a warning for someone else. This is a very individual situation, and it depends on the specifics. You don't want to go around sowing fear amongst other people. I said to her, okay, you know, what's your relationship with this guy? Well, I haven't seen him for a long time, many years. I do have his phone number. He's down in Memphis. She's living in upstate New York. He's down in Memphis. He's a left brain type, a trial attorney. I'm listening to all this. Then she says, he knows I'm a nut. I said, okay, that gives us something to work with. If it were my life, if it were my situation, I might now consider, I say to her, calling him up and just telling him the dream without commentary. I can say this is really weird, the sort of preface that people give. I might do it that way, or I might alternatively try and get the information to him in some roundabout way, which would be smarter in many situations. She decides she'll be really bold about this. She will call him up. Can you imagine what guts that takes, calling up a former boyfriend with a dream like this? And again, I'm not counseling our listeners to do this with any dream that seems threatening for someone else. You've got to do a lot of work before you would presume to do such a thing, because this can be self-fulfilling. You don't want to sow fear. So I'm not counseling you to do this next step, but I just want to finish the story for now. She calls him up, tells him the dream, and her heart is sort of sinking because she thinks he's going to think I want him dead or something. There's a silence on the end of the phone. Then the lawyer comes back on and says, thank you very much. I know that parking lot. I know that building. Unknown to the dreamer, he's been doing work for a legislative committee down there in Memphis. And he's been meeting his wife on Friday nights. The woman is his wife. She'd never met the wife. He's been meeting his wife at 7 p.m. on Friday nights, even though the parking lot is a dangerous, deserted place at night. And because of her dream warning, he decides to change his habits and meet her at a restaurant in a safer part of town. What is this? It's an illustration of process, but what's going on here? This is not dream precognition. This is not a prophetic dream because the lawyer was not attacked and killed. We don't want him to be attacked and killed. We want to learn to get smart enough.
That's why you have warning signals.
Yes, we learn to get smart. We need to learn to get smart enough to heed warning signals we receive in dreams for the benefit of ourselves or of others. This woman has a warning dream for the benefit of another person. She's able to use it wisely and sensibly after doing the intelligent, necessary preparatory work. You don't take this kind of action without preparing the ground very carefully. How does she clarify the meaning of the dream? Here's the process. She goes back inside the dream. This technique, which I call dream reentry, is central to my approach of working with dreams. It's central to conscious dreaming, to learn to go back inside your dream so you're not banging around in the fog with a few feeble memories of something blurred that you say, oh, gee, this is weird, or gee, this is trivial. Stop judging your dreams. Stop editing them. Learn to honor them as real experiences. How do you do that? You go back inside. You face the adversary, you clarify the message, as in this case, and then, this is a vital part of the process, you do something with the information. It is important to honor our dreams and the source from which they come. Otherwise, you're like someone who's constantly getting...
Otherwise, you're constantly getting
good advice from a friend who calls you up. You know, there's a problem at your company, at your office. She knows because she's in the boardroom listening, and she's calling you up. Hey, look, you better get ready. and you never thank her, you don't even listen to her warnings, you're out in the street and you wonder why. You know, your friend is going to be fed up with you, you're going to suffer the consequences of not heeding her warnings, and you're going to be generally unhappy. So, as a Huichol shaman in Mexico says, if we do not do something with our dreams, we will not dream well. This is about a lot more than dream interpretation. This is about dream enactment and bringing the energy and insight of the dream into waking life.
I've been able, many, even years later, to go back inside a dream that had a profound effect on me. And if I sit very still and I recall that dream, suddenly it starts unfolding. The line continues, the storyline continues. You can slip right back into it. Do you have any other tips for getting back into a dream? And
relax. Relax.
Back to relaxing again.
I mean, breathing techniques work. You know, I'll have to say something more about the drumming. I mean, in a workshop situation or working with a partner or just putting a drumming tape on for yourself, the drumming, this monotonous, primal, heartbeat drumming, it does help left-brain-centered, rational, scientifically educated Westerners to shift consciousness. I was once literally chased, by two Freudian analysts from the Sigmund Freud Institute in Frankfurt after conducting a workshop in Holland where I'd used drumming to facilitate dream reentry and tracking. You're taking a partner into the dream with you to be your escort and help you check your information. These Freudians chased after me to tell me they just had the most vivid visual impressions of their lifetimes, waking or sleeping, and they had proof, the most convincing proof of telepathy they'd ever come across. So there are techniques
Hallelujah,
we can use.
The scientist experienced the experience.
I want to say something to you and to our listeners and remind myself of this. Never listen to anyone's opinion on dreams or other adventures in consciousness until you establish what this person's personal experience is. Not the piece of paper on the wall, not the academic degree, not the profession, but their personal experience. I won't listen to anyone on dreams who claims to be an expert. In fact, I will rarely listen to anyone who claims to be an expert on anything. But I will not accept anyone's competence to counsel on dreams until I establish that he or she is a frequent flyer who does a lot of this stuff and has explored its possibilities, not closing off other people's sense of possibility. Don't listen to people because they have a degree or a certification. Listen to them because they're frequent flyers in this area.
And we'll come right back with Robert Moss on Conscious Dreaming. I'm Laura Lee. We are back on the Laura Lee Show. We're talking with Robert Moss. The topic is Conscious Dreaming. His book is Conscious Dreaming, A Spiritual Path for Everyday Life. Softcover book, 348 pages. The retail price is $16. It's a very, very good read. Robert has requested that we give him the space and the time to tell one of his own pivotal big dream moments and events, and we'd like him to do that, just that.
Well, I think I'm going to choose a dream that I can tell rather briefly, Laura, although you've been generous enough to offer me space for this. I think it's very important to say to our listeners, not only trust your dreams, but remember that a big dream can be a watershed in your life, and after that watershed, it can be a talisman you go back to that contains fire and courage and confirmation for you of the path you're on. So I'm going to tell a dream I can tell fairly briefly, which was a watershed dream for me in the sense that at the time I had it, I was still confused about competing agendas in my life. Part of me was saying, follow the path of soul and spirit and give yourself to it totally. A part of me was saying, well, you know, where's the money going to come from? You know, make some other compromise. Put some more money in the bank and then serve the soul. These are not contrary purposes. But at the time in my confusion, like many people in this culture, I thought that they were contrary purposes. So I had asked for dream guidance, a very simple technique. You know, actually, people listening to us, you might want to ask for your dream guidance on a theme that concerns you. Write your question down on a piece of paper, put it under your pillow, and sleep on it. I'd written my question to do with money and holding things together and put it under my pillow. And I got a dream that I had not asked for, but it was much better. In my dream, I'm going through clogged and, you know, confusing streets, and I'm having a hard time getting anywhere, as I was in life at the time. And then suddenly, I am drawn by an invisible but powerful force in a direction opposite to the one I have insisted on taking. Are you with me so far? I've insisted in going forward, you know, through this clogged and uncomfortable landscape in a certain direction. Suddenly, an invisible being like a winged dragon seizes me by the shoulders and starts pulling me backwards in the opposite direction. I don't have to move with it, but I choose to go with it. I'm conscious of free choice. I'm drawn in the opposite direction to where? To a circle of people who live very close to the earth. They're gathered around a large fire pit. They're drumming and chanting. And I'm a little uneasy. Am I an intruder amongst these people, these dream people who live close to the earth? They show me there is a place prepared for me in their circle. I sit with them and chant with them and drum with them. And when the fire becomes friendly, I lie at the center of the circle. And they do something very interesting. They take red-hot glowing coals from the fire, and they lay the coals over my eyes and over my ears. And they place a coal on my tongue. And they place a red-hot coal over my heart. And they say in beautiful, musical, cadenced speech, "We do this to open your eyes that you may see clearly. We do this to change your ears so you may hear clearly. We do this to open your mouth so you may speak truly. And we do this at the heart to open the passage from your heart to your mouth so that henceforth you'll speak only from the heart." Well, I woke up charged with energy and juice. We need energy as well as insight, and we can get it from our dreams. I jumped in my car. I drove to a lake 10 miles from my house, and in the soft morning and a gentle rain, I made a self-offering. To the trees, to the lake, to the red-tailed hawk that came kiting through the clouds, I said, as a personal commitment and dream enactment, I said, "Henceforth, I will speak and act only from the heart." This changed my life. From that moment, I became in public what I had been called to be, a teacher of what? Of playing the game of life, of living your best dreams. It was that dream of my dream people that confirmed me in that purpose, gave me the courage to go forward. And it's a dream amongst others that I go back often to sit at its fire, to gain from its warmth, to renew my courage and passion for the journey. Everyone listening to us can do the same. That's a wonderful thing about this game of life.
You know, it might be very dangerous not to listen to those persistent callings of those dreams. You also, in your book, tell the story of a Zulu woman who was being called by her ancestors and her dream guides to be the shaman that she was meant to be, and she was resisting. Can you tell us that story?
She got sick, you know, she got very sick, and finally her ancestors warned her in her dreams that if she did not become a shaman, if she did not become a spiritual practitioner, she would die. She decided to practice finally, and she got well. You know, sometimes we get sick in an initiation illness, in a spiritual emergency. We get sick because we are not listening to the command of the spirit, to the call of the spirit. I think some of my childhood illnesses were related. Well, I was not able as a child. I didn't have the independence as a child to respond fully to the call of spirit, and I didn't have people around me who would validate what was going on. I think I got sort of disgusted. But, you know, the Iroquois Indians say that dreams are the wishes of the soul. And they also say that if you do not listen to the desires of the soul, the secret wishes of the soul, as manifested in your dreams, then you will become sick and part of your soul will go away and you'll eventually die. Big news. We are born dying. People are so terrified of death in our culture. They don't understand it's a swing door and that they should be ready for life after life and that dreaming is a way to prepare for that. So dreams are wishes of the soul, and if you don't heed the voice of the soul, you're going to get sick, because if part of your soul energy goes away, you have left a space where sickness can come in, and your boundaries are down, and you are not protected. Dreaming, in these many senses of the word, is a way of keeping up your energy, keeping up your vital radiance, bringing the soul energy back into yourself, and this is the heart of healing. Dreaming is central to healing. Dreams in themselves can be healing experiences. To be shut off from your inner sources is sickness. It makes you a spiritual and emotional cripple and vulnerable to all sorts of bad stuff.
Think what our society would be like if we paid attention to our dreams. Then we would understand that there was life after life. Then we would understand that we are eternal souls. And then we wouldn't have this rampant consumerism where we have one-night stands with our natural resources and believe that now is all that we care about. We would care about the future as well. We would have a very different orientation to life and how we conduct ourselves in this 3D reality, wouldn't we?
That's right. I mean, it's funny. People think that, you know, dreaming and paying attention to dreams divorces you from physical reality. I find the reverse. You know, if you start paying attention to your dreams in the sense of sleep dreams, you'll notice that everything in your dreams is actually alive. We do games of dream theater in my workshops where people will act out their dreams and choose a cast of players to impersonate the characters in their dreams. Someone will be playing the rug on the floor that gets trodden on. Someone will be playing the fire hydrant that the dog lifts the leg against. Someone will be playing the dog. Everything in your dreams is alive. When you notice that, you might also notice that everything in the world around you, the physical world, is also alive. So you won't regard a tree as just a tree. Actually, trees are sometimes wiser than people. You won't regard, you know, the grass as just, you know, just a rug that you step on. Actually, you won't even regard a rug as just a rug. If you see that everything is alive, you notice that spirit is everywhere, and you'll start honoring your relationship to other species, to the earth itself, and to other people.
And again, life will be that very glorious adventure. How do we encourage ourselves to remember our dreams more clearly? A quick tip sheet on that.
Remember to play. This is a game. It's not another chore to add to the drudgery of life. It should be fun. Dreams are a magic carpet ride. The fact that they're also the best rehearsals for challenges in waking life you can ever do is secondary. First of all, they are magic carpet rides. If you want to do it, as with any other game, you'll make some time and resources available. It's not very expensive. Your pen and paper is all you need. You need to make a little space available in the morning. Don't let yourself be jolted out of sleep by, you know, a talk radio and the noise of the outside world and the need to get caffeine and get to the office straight away. Allow yourself a little time to hang out, to relax. Focus your intention. Write down on a piece of paper. It's already a personal ritual. I wish to remember my dreams. I wish to work with my dreams. I wish to play with my dreams. I would like dream guidance on such and such. Write something down. Put it by your bed or under your pillow. Pillow talk. Then in the morning, allow yourself that little time to languor. If you don't have any dream memories initially, relax. You know, wiggle around in bed gently and softly. Sometimes by rearranging your body into the postures of the night, you can coax back a dream that came when you were lying in a certain position. If you still have no dream memory, relax. Write something down. Your thoughts, feelings, bodily sensations. You have a dream hangover, even if you don't remember what caused it. And relate whatever you put down back to your question. When you write something down, you're saying to your dream source, I'm here, I'm listening, I'm ready to record. This is the way you begin. I want to say this as clearly and forcefully as I can. When you dream the future in a dream, you are dreaming a possible future. It doesn't have to happen. Don't run off into some fatalist attitude. If you dream of something terrible, that gives you the power of choice to do something to avoid that dream event if you don't like it. Kristen, although she may not have been clearly aware of it, clearly did something to avoid a terrible event perceived in a dream. She took practical precautions to secure the safety of the child she saw threatened in the dream. If this were my experience, I would think that actually, whether I was clear about it or not, the precautions I took after the dream to protect my child may have prevented that child from running into the horrible thing I saw in the dream. I'm not interested in this theory, the reincarnational theories here. As I said, as a Celt, I have a sympathy for theories of reincarnation. But I'm not going to run away and hand the power and insight that a dream that might be precognitive gives me over to some other person who gives me some theory. I don't like that. I like the fact that whatever her theory, Kristen in practice, did something to act in a practical way about a possible warning involving her son's security. So don't give away your own power of decision to some theory offered to you by someone else, even if they call themselves a psychic, an alien visitor from another galaxy, or anything else.
Now, history might have been different had a couple of people paid attention to their dreams. You mentioned in your book, Calpurnia, the wife of Julius Caesar, dreamed his assassination, both literally and symbolically, before it then actually happened. And Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, dreamed that he saw his own body in a coffin in the East Room of the White House 2 weeks before his assassination. History could have been different if those people had paid attention to their dreams and took the necessary precautions.
Absolutely. It's interesting that Caesar didn't get the message because Caesar's dreams influenced his actions as a Roman military commander. It was a dream that led him to cross the Tiber and take Rome and make himself master of Rome. But when his wife was dreaming on his behalf, he somehow didn't get the message. Abe Lincoln believed in dreams. He was a highly intuitive man. His dream memory was probably not specific enough to act on. You know, if you dream of a plane crash and you avoid all plane flights for 10 years, I mean, you know, you're not doing anyone a service.
Least of all yourself.
You need to be, that's why we need to develop the technique of going back inside the dream and getting more information so we can be quite specific. If I dream of a threat to one of my children, as Kristen did, for example, I want to get this straight. I want to get clearer information. I want to know where this could possibly have happened so I can take rational, sensible precautions. I told you about reentry in the case of the dream of the Memphis muggers. And the possible death of an attorney perceived by a dreamer. Dream reentry provided the clues to work practically and carefully with better information.
And my husband Paul was telling you before our interview about his own dreams where he dreamed car accidents and then they happened, but they happened under slightly different circumstances. For example, I wasn't in the car with him. So how? What could he have done in his case?
First of all, gotten more accurate information. A friend of mine who is an African shaman, actually an African divination priest, once said to me that there are only two things in life which cannot be changed. One is the character you are born with, your basic character. You have to work with that or against it. I mean, if you're born with a tiger in you, you're not a sheep, and you should never try to behave like a sheep. You might try and gentle that tiger inside yourself, but you've got to work with it, not against it. And secondly, your maximum allotment of time and energy in this world, your maximum lifespan, that's an awfully hard thing to change. He said, but almost anything else can be changed if you become more aware of possibility and your possibility of free choice. My approach, this conscious dreaming approach, leads to a maximizing your free will and your power of choice instead of handing it away to some theory or other person. You can change a lot. You can see the future, you can change it.
It's all about maxing our potentials and using information to give us more choice in life. We'll come right back with Robert Moss. I'm Laura Lee. Laura Lee, back on The Laura Lee Show, talking with Robert Moss on conscious dreaming. There were some comments you told me you wanted to make about the art of storytelling.
One of the wonderful things about sharing dreams is it builds the art of telling stories. We need to be storytellers. We need to learn or remember how to tell our own stories in a way that gets other people to listen to us and pay attention to us. To pay attention means literally to stretch yourself. We need to learn to tell our stories in a simple, clear, effective way. We can learn to do this very naturally by sharing dreams. Now, you know, when people are sharing dreams in one of my groups, in one of my workshops, I encourage them, first of all, tell the dream as an experience in its own right. Don't tell us about the rest of your life. Don't tell us about the background to the dream. Don't interpret, don't judge, don't edit. Make the dream a simple story. Just tell it in the present tense, if you can, as simply and clearly as possible, so we can see it and enter the dream with you. Think of your dream as a story and give it a title, as you would give a story a title. This isn't a literary endeavor. You're not trying to get a Pulitzer Prize. Just put a title on the story that is the first phrase that comes into your mind that seems to relate to the dream. By putting a title to your dream story, you are already beginning to distill its basic meaning and content, which makes it easier to handle the great volume of information you'll start getting if you start catching more and more dreams, because, I mean, it's immense. But, you know, this is also wonderful entertainment. I just feel so sad that American families and other Western families, they sit around in front of the TV in place of the old fireplace, not talking to each other when they could be playing games of this kind, sharing stories, playing with them, acting them out, discussing them. It's a wonderful way to get over our inhibitions and difficulties of communicating with each other. But best of all, it's this. You learn to tell your own story. You learn to communicate better. Other people will listen to you more attentively. And you'll be able to present yourself in other situations. By learning to tell your own story in one respect, you'll learn to communicate and tell your story in many, many other practical ways in life.
Storytelling for millennia has been the means of passing on wisdom in those indigenous cultures.
Yes, so you know, the Greeks before Socrates used to say that truth is what we remember and enact. Truth is what we remember and enact. You know, if you have to look something up in a book, it's not part of your personal possession. That doesn't belong to you. If you've got a dry series of abstract theories that don't live in you and are not available to you when you need to do it to deal with a crisis, you don't have personal truth in an instantly accessible and powerful form. And whatever you truly believe is something you are going to act on when you're tested in life. Stories give us something we can remember easily, and we can act on. They give us juice and energy. We really need stories for our journey. We need to revive the art of the sacred teaching story that has been central to community and shared spirituality and the realization of what it is to be human in so many of the world's cultures. We've lost our common teaching stories, and the ones that we know have got dry and boring and softened by repetition. You know, we need to get the raw primal stories back. Shall I tell you a raw primal story?
Yes, please.
This is a story that was taught by the gentle vegetarian philosophers of Advaita Vedanta from India. And I mention that because it's a very raw, savage story that is meant, as all great stories from great teachers are meant, to shock us awake. Here is the picture I will paint for you, and it will be like a dream for you. Here is the mother tigress going through the forest, and she's hungry because she has two lives to feed. She is pregnant. Here are the goats grazing out on the plain. She sees the possibility of lunch. She prepares for her spring. She leaps. She's awkward because she's heavily pregnant. She hits her head against a protruding rock. She dies. The goats come back. They see the cub that is born posthumously. Oh, poor little thing. Meow, meow, poor little mewling tiger cub. They decide to raise the cub as a goat and teach it to eat grass and to bleat. Well, the would-be, you know, goat never really fits in, but, you know, he's with the herd for a while, till the man-eater, the Bengal tiger, the male tiger, comes along. He's always hungry. He leaps at the goats. They run away, except for the would-be goat that doesn't run. The male tiger looks down at him. What are you doing here? The would-be goat looks up and goes, meh. The man-eater says, you're not a goat. Meh. The tiger cub starts eating grass. The man-eater roars, you're not a goat. We don't eat grass. He grabs the cub by the scruff of the neck and carries him to a reflecting pool and shows him his true face in the mirror of the waters. And what do you think the would-be goat does? He screams and squeals in terror. The man-eater grabs him and carries him back to his lair, where he has the remains of the gazelle he was eating for breakfast, and stuffs the bloody meat down the cub's throat. And as the juice runs through his body, the cub opens his jaws and he roars. And the Bengal tiger says to him, now you know who you are, we can begin to discuss how you ought to behave. This is the story. It is a teaching story. What is it about? It may have shocked some of our listeners, particularly if you're a vegetarian, which is fine. It's told by vegetarians. It's not about meat eating as a spiritual practice, although you could interpret it that way, I suppose, if that's your thing. It's about what? It's about the encounter between your little self and your big self, your tiger self. The reason we can always encounter our big self, our higher self, is it is hunting us. We go around in our delusional daily mind thinking we're doing this or that, we're going to be masters of the universe or whatever. Your higher self, your tiger self, is hunting you. That's why you can actually find it, because it's looking for you. And it's looking for an opening where you will put down your theories, your habits, your preconceptions, and let it through. Dream work is one way of accessing the tiger in your soul.
So we are so concerned about going off and finding our higher self. Maybe we should just sit and listen when it comes knocking and pay attention is one of your points. Also, if we sit and let our mind be filled of scientific theories, which really only give half the picture of the universe, the picture of the physical reality, we know that there's much, much more to the universe. And if we look to maybe ancient wisdom, we might get a clue as to the other half. But if we let our minds be filled with theories, it's the same thing as giving our power over to a guru, somebody else that gives us a picture of reality that isn't authentically coming from our own. Scientific theories are useful. They're one data stream out of many with which we can piece together our experience. Personally, I like it when my experience, my intuition, and my intellect come together. But let's not forget our experience is at the very basis. You know, Stories, and the passing on of stories as teaching tools. I've been told that in many Native American families, an uncle or an aunt will tell stories to a child to deliver a lesson that that child desperately needs, rather than having the parents scold it. It's much nicer to have a story being told to illustrate the point, and they get it. It's delivered in no uncertain terms, but gently. We have amnesia across the board here. We have forgotten in the West our storytelling tradition. Do you have any thoughts as to what caused that amnesia? Why have we cut ourselves off from the heritage, the heritage of the Greeks and their dreaming traditions, for example? What happened to us?
Well, the two great adversaries of natural storytelling, telling our own stories from a personal depth, are also the adversaries of dream working and spiritual healing in the history of Western culture. The first was the early church, once it became ruled by censors and judges and middlemen who wanted to come between people and their own experience. The early church wasn't like that. The history of organized religion is much the same all over the world. Along comes the spiritual leader, who might or might not be regarded as an incarnation of the deity. And he or she heals in the manner of a shaman, and teaches by telling stories, and infuses energy and lost soul with his or her breath into those who walk with him or her, and is cast out or killed by the respectable people of the time. Then after his or her death, some time later, along come the same people, the spiritual heirs of the people who killed that leader, and they claim to be his descendants, and claim to be the only purveyors of his message, and take people's experience away from them, and deny the possibility of personal revelation of the sacred, deny the possibility of a personal gateway to transcendence. So first of all, we have the middlemen, the organization men, in clerical collars and clerical robes, who demonized half the cosmos and said it was not okay to have a personal experience or talk about it. You know, the sacred was something to come through a book interpreted by them. We know what this is about. The second group of people who are enemies of both the dreaming and the storytelling, the authentic personal storytelling of visionary experience and so on, from which all our mythologies and world religions are born. They're born from what? From personal visionary experience. The second group of enemies are the kind of scientific reductionists who reduce the mind to the brain and say that the brain is a computer made of meat. And that there's nothing out there that is real or trustworthy, that cannot be proven in a laboratory by quantitative methods. That anything that cannot be proven by quantitative methods ain't real, ain't so. These are not real scientists. The great scientists have always lived by intuition and dreaming. Even Sir Isaac Newton, certainly Einstein. Think of that.
The great scientists were mystics.
Yes, the great scientists have always been practical mystics. It's not the scientists who are the problem, it's the people who think they are scientific and have some dumb, dull ideology of scientism that reduces the world to the evidence of the senses. It's nonsense. So these have been the enemies in our culture, and we need to forget about them and get on with the interesting business of being human and remembering that we are spiritual beings.
And empowering our own lives.
And claiming our own power. Claiming our own power.
Next caller to the Laura Lee Show for Robert Moss is, hello.
Yes, this is Lisa from Oregon.
Hi, Lisa.
I have a question. At the beginning of the interview, Mr. Moss mentioned Alpha Centauri. If he knows any connection between the Australian Aborigines and Alpha Centauri.
Well, I can't think of a specific connection of Aboriginal stories at Alpha Centauri. We talked about the Dogon stories of the Sirius star system. Native peoples do have different stories about different systems in the cosmos. The Aboriginals may have one. I'm not personally aware of it. I think when I quote Alpha Centauri, I'm often thinking of that old song, you know. We're all crazy. We're on a ship bound for Alpha Centauri, but we have to believe in magic even if we are crazy. You remember the old song. I won't try and sing it for you. You must believe in magic. If you believe in, you must believe in the guiding hand, etc. And Alpha Centauri is mentioned as a destination for the ship. Yeah.
But what I find interesting is that the Egyptians, for example, had a real thing with the star Sirius and the star Orion, for example. And I'm told by a Greek scholar that all of the ancient peoples believe that they came from the heavens, that the stars were gateways to other dimensions, and that we were here on Earth as you would going to a classroom for a period of time to learn a certain bodies of lessons, and they believe that when we died we went back to the heavens, back to our true homes. And it's so interesting that all of the cultures, with ours being the exception, that was their cosmogony, their cosmology, that very much comes from a relationship to the dream world, doesn't it?
Yes, as you know, the ancient Egyptian name for priest means a star watcher, and it means it not just in the sense of following the movement of stars as an astrologer does, it means someone who remembers the connection between the human spirit and the star systems and is able to travel in some sense through the stargates and resume contact. There's a practice of star walking. Actually, it's called that. It's called star walking in Taoism. There's a Taoist practice called star walking, which consists essentially of making a personal ecstatic journey, a trance journey, to a chosen constellation, and receiving certain insight during a visit. So once again, it's about claiming your own power. There's a lot more you can do for yourself than many of us seem to be aware, and we are being invited to remember what the spirit already knows. Yes, we have different degrees of skill. We also have different degrees of courage and preparedness, and we need to be grounded in all of this. You know, when I get a certain kind of person come to my workshop whose head is full of weird and wonderful and delightful theories, I want to get that person's feet on the ground, make sure the diet, exercise, relationships are being treated seriously, that person has an adequate ego and intellectual structure to handle what is coming through. But, you know, having said all that, you know, you're ready to travel to the stars. Why not? Your spirit is starborn. It's your natural place.
There is a, in the Lascaux cave paintings, there is a picture of a shaman at a angle with a symbol of a bird next to his head, and he's assuming a specific body posture, which Dr. Felicitas Goodman, who's an anthropologist, believes is a formula to go traveling, that our hunter-gatherer ancestors had various body postures that were assumed and handed down so they would take specific journeys. When her students assumed that particular posture, which is lying down flat and putting your arms at a certain angle, that very often they just felt ecstatic. That's why she calls it ecstatic body postures.
There's a connection between this and the ecstatic journey, just as there is in dreaming. Sexual excitation, I mean, major muscle groups close down when we're dreaming or traveling in this way, or else we'd be acting out our dreams, but our sexual organs do not. In women, the same signs are apparent. It's one of the clearest signs of having an out-of-body experience during your sleep dreams.
Welcome right back with the last couple of moments for Robert Moss. I'm Laura Lee. Hey, Laura Lee, back on The Laura Lee Show, talking with Robert Moss, who's making the very good point that the spirit world is real, and yet we need to be discriminating about who we talk to among those entities therein.
The spirit world is real, have no doubt about that. Spirits are real, but you don't necessarily want to entertain any, all and sundry, you know, from the spiritual plane. It's like opening your house in the middle of the night and saying, hey, to the street, come in and party, anyone's welcome. You know, you need to identify and discriminate. You need to identify and discriminate what you're dealing with. If you're dealing with something that you want to deal with in terms of submission or dominance, S&M sort of stuff, you don't want to be, you know, with that thing. If you find your energy level is falling, you want to cut off that relationship, because there are psychic vampires who feed on us. Some of them have bodies and some of them don't. So you need to learn some simple discrimination. I give basic guidelines in the book. There's not time to go through them now, but it's very important to identify and discriminate any spiritual entity that is communicating with you, and test and verify information and messages, and check your energy level afterwards.
Next caller to the Laura Lee Show for Robert Moss. Hello.
Hi. This is Joe in Danville, California. My question is, I'm one of the millions of people who are taking antidepressants on a long-term basis, and scientifically, at least, these are supposed to affect our dreaming capabilities. How much can I trust what I dream, considering that I've been on these drugs now for 13 years?
I doubt that the drugs are influencing your dream content. They may, as you say, be influencing the frequency of your dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
In relation to depression, I'm very interested in recent psychological studies, recent medical studies that suggest that increased dream recall and working with dreams are characteristic of recovery from depression. So that when we begin to dream more and do more with our dreams, the symptoms of depression are actually falling away. So the fact that you are now having dream recall and after all the these years of medication is a very positive sign for you, and I would encourage you. Yes, well, you know it in your feelings. That's great.
I feel better.
I would encourage you strongly to go ahead, play with your dreams, catch more, write up the stories. This in itself will be a profound healing, probably, for you.
You know, that's so nice, because I've always been worried that I've been dreaming falsely.
I wouldn't worry about that.
Thanks.
I think your dreams are coming as part of your healing process, and I'm very glad that you shared this experience with us.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, and good luck. You wanted to share with us a couple of tips about using the techniques that you talk about, the shamanic techniques for gaining awareness in our dreams, applying those to life in general. What do you have to say about that?
All right,
I
have a lot to say, but let me give you a very simple exercise, a very simple game you can play in your life over the next 24 hours.
Okay.
It begins with this. I'd like you to reach down deep inside yourself and find the question or theme you really need guidance on in your life at the moment. Don't take this from the top level of your consciousness. Reach down inside yourself and formulate the question or the theme you would really like guidance on in your life at the moment. And when you have this question, I want you to write it down and carry it with you, put it in your pocket or your pocketbook, and carry your question as you go about in the world. And when you have your question, make this your intention. The first unusual, weird, unexpected, coincidental event I notice, or pattern I notice in the world around me, could be a message from the world about my question. And when you notice something strange, unexpected, chance encounter, random event, coincidence, see if you can relate that back to your question. Let me give you a very simple example of how this works. A woman came to one of my groups who'd forgotten how to dream. It's a common problem in this society. She'd forgotten how to dream basically because she was scared. She was scared she was going to lose her job and she didn't want to take the guidance from her dream. So she'd blocked out her dream source. I said, go and play this game with the world. She goes out. She comes back and she says, I got the message from the world immediately. I had my question, am I going to keep my job? And I noticed that for three or four blocks in a downtown area I know well, I'm driving the wrong way down a one-way street. And I don't wake up to this until a truck driver leans on his horn and puts on his high beams and nearly runs me down. I said, did you get your answer? Yes, I've got to get off this one-way street I'm driving the wrong way on. Got this job as a loser. Once she came to that realization, she was getting her dreams, and on the basis of her dreams, she landed a much better job in another city. Two months later, her job was abolished, so she would have been out of work. She got a message from the world, and then she got confirmation from her dream source, and she was able to enact this in a way that was very positive for her life.
That, again, makes life quite an adventure, doesn't it? And it also puts a responsibility onto us not to live our lives passively and be blown about by the winds, but to be active and to use the clues, to be a detective, to have all our sensors out there and working, to be gathering up, to have a flow. It's kind of like having a dialogue. I think it's an interactive universe. It comes hunting after us. It wants our attention. It wants to engage us in conversation. You do that, and the life force begins to flow through you in the universe back and forth in that circuit, that cycle, much more readily, and you feel so much more alive, and the adventure becomes worth living. Robert, thank you. This has been a delight to share with you. Any last words?
I just want to say to you and your listeners, Laura, may you all dream well, and may your best dreams come true.
Thank you for the adventure. Thank you for listening. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online. www.lauralee.com